So in The Triumph of Human Empire and the Machine in the Garden, both of you have written about writers and thinkers in the latter half of the 19th century who were particularly attuned to the hazards of the encroachment of human empire during that period and drawn to some middle ground, a landscape or timescape not dominated by human presence but hospitable to human experience.
Whoa, capture that sentence. that's a very...
Inclusive.
Yeah, very inclusive, and but also accurate.
So that is writers and thinkers who imaginatively shared the pastoral impulse and literally practiced some form of pastoral retreat. I'm thinking of your three, Ross, Jules Verne, William Morris, and Robert Louis Stevenson, and across the Atlantic, Thoreau, Melville, Twain. So what does that look like in these two environments? How did it manifest itself? Similarly and differently, these two collective consciousnesses and in the work of the writers who articulated them and were perhaps particularly prescient about what they saw.
Okay, so this is a major topic.
Yeah, what did they share or not their response to what they saw as a world change or a transformed landscape? I mean, you could say that the Americans were more optimistic. They had a more open environment. I mean, there were a lot of ways to look at the parallels and the differences. You know, the railroad in Europe had already infiltrated. Yeah. It was, for Thoreau, such a big symbol of the frontier was gone. You know, it was a different world they inhabited to some degree.
Different?
In the sense that their immediate environment may have, you know, was different. I mean, they shared these impulses and this consciousness, but in different environments.
But the geography is
very
different. Because, Leo, I can't tell you how many times I've seen you draw on a blackboard. It's like, here's the seaboard, here's the wilderness, and in the middle, you know, is a middle landscape, which you always will say, it's not a place, it's an ideal, or it's a relationship. But that does assume a continent. It's organized, you know, you've drawn the American continent. So the question I had was, well, if you're in Europe, you don't have that, the drawing is different. You don't have it.
You have the Atlantic Ocean in the middle.
Yeah, that's one, or... What I, you know, the more I read about what these people were trying to say, I concluded that they moved to the water, not necessarily to the Atlantic, but to some water-based experience was the closest that they could find to a pastoral retreat. It was moving from land to water. And it depended, you know, like... For Jules Verne, it was sailing off, sailing in the North Sea. It was sailing, but it was coastal sailing for the most part. He wasn't trying to go that far, but he was hugging the shore, but sailing. And Stevenson went paddling on the canals.
What these had in common was a landscape that was malleable, that could be used to suit their needs and more than the one they came from. You come from an environment with fixed institutions and so on, and you go to one which is much less finished and susceptible to your influence.
Lucy, you're going to say.
Well, when you mentioned water, I was thinking of Thoreau, Walden Pond, Twain on the river, I mean, Huck Finn on the river, Melville at sea. I mean, it is very much
present in the American.
In fact, so much so that in the discussion of water and landscape in the first few paragraphs of Moby Dick, the implication is any landscape that you're interested in has water. We're not interested in landscapes that don't have water. It's almost absolutely true.
Yeah. No, that's actually, I quote Melville because I can't not quote him, gazing at the sea.
It's
just, even if you're in Manhattan, That's what people do. By the way, the first chapter I wrote about Jules Verne is titled Life on the Loire. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to, and I don't know whether anybody's going to recognize Life on the Mississippi, but that is the idea. Because again, it's a river, but it's a very specific river, and every river is different. Right. And so you can't just, you have to look at the specifics as well as the general experience. How about Thoreau, though? I'm thinking, I mean, he swims in Walden, he paddles around.
He measures it.
The book is called
Walden. Walden. It's got 18 chapters. The tenth chapter is called The Pond, and it is organized around the concept of the pond, actually. And the pond in winter is where he goes through the pond, the seasons, and he comes to the pond. And now he goes under and to measure its depth, and the depth becomes a metaphor for the plumbing of human consciousness.
I mean, it does make sense that water, on the one hand, is sort of the primal ingredient of life, and on the other hand, it's finite in the sense that, it could be what we end up not having enough of.
Yeah, yeah.
And that sort of that impulse to go back to the water makes a lot of sense for people who are sort of kind of calibrating where we're all at in terms of the dominance.
So much so that you'd be hard-pressed to find many landscapes written that didn't have water. I mean,
Or that appeal, that arouse meditation.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, lest we get too sappy about water, shall we say, it's also very scary and very frightening, the flooding of the Mississippi. In this respect, William Morris is such an interesting example because he loves the Thames, he knows the Thames, he fishes there, he wades there, he swims, it's his river. But he also goes to Iceland. And when he takes a pony trek around Iceland, they have to cross the rivers on ponies. And these are rushing, glacial-fed waters. And he's terrified. So for him, crossing the river becomes a test of courage. And I will add, of the ponies' courage. Mm-hmm. They felt like the ponies were the real heroes of crossing the river. But so then when he comes back to England and becomes a soldier.
Who is this?
This is William Morris. Yeah. So he comes back to England and becomes a socialist. And his metaphor for becoming a socialist is crossing the river of fire. And of course, Iceland has a lot of fire in that landscape too.
Right.
And I have to think that metaphor comes out of, there's something really scary. The water's, it looks like you can't get across, but you have to believe you can cross that river, and you just do it. And I think it, as I say, it's a reminder that water is not always blissful or peaceful.
Oh, right.
It's anything but meaningful.
Yes, and sort of a vantage point to look at civilization by retreating from it to some degree or moving away from it.
Yeah.
I mean, I definitely think, Thoreau, obviously, but Huck Finn, Melville. I mean, and I'm sure, is that true in...
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course, Verne is...
Yes. and then the retreat to, Robert Louis Stevenson. Yeah.
But Stevenson... when he's a young man and he's paddling around Northern Europe, and it's kind of,
it's middlescape.
Yeah, it's wonderfully evocative of the middle landscape. But then when he ends up in the South Pacific, where you've also been, right?
Yeah.
In the latter 8 years of his life, or seven, anyway, latter years of his life, then he's seeing this invasion of, it's both Western imperialism of the late 19th century, but it's also human empire on a larger scale. It's just Polynesia, which is a world of islands, is being overrun by another world. And that is just, it's a tragedy. And he sees it as a whole other way of life because it's based on water entirely, the Polynesians. And that's just something that most Westerners never experienced. And so his great mission was to try to explain to his audience back home what this new world is like. And people back home just, for the most part, were not like, why is he writing about these strange people? So he never got an audience for those works until recently, when now much more
attuned. Yeah. Another thing that you raised in your book is this concept of an event of consciousness, and something you said that came out of conversation between the two of you. And it the notion that the various components of material experience and material reality are not necessarily what determine a pivotal moment, but sort of how those things are integrated in the imagination can be the sort of pivotal element of it. And that sort of raises the question of why you looked at writers as the sort of ones who can help us sort of understand a moment in history and an experience of sort of a shift in human reality.
You know, as you were introducing that thought, my impulse was to turn it around and say that what we turn to writers to better understand a virtually universal experience of water and so on, that the writers didn't discover it. People did. I mean, it's part of human experience. And they used, so that at the end of the central chapter of Walden, which is called The Pond, he says that the locals think the pond is, they have a theory that the pond is bottomless. He said, but I can assure you that it has a very tight bottom. In fact, I went to prove it. And then he has this wonderful description measuring the depth of the pond. You know, he took a piece of string, he tied it to a rock, he lay on his belly, he cut a hole in the ice, he dropped the thing, he pulled it up, he allowed it, and it all builds up to this wonderful concluding line. And he said, as long as there are ponds, some will be thought to be bottomless, but I but I can assure you that they all have bottom.
You know, you're mentioning that wonderful well, the chapter and that part of it, you know, brings up another way of answering your question, Lucy, about writers. They, all the guys, I think, that we are, that we're interested in as writers, are they are interested in, quote, science and technology. I mean, they're not, you know, just lying out in the woods, blue skying it, as the saying goes. Because, I mean, I think of Thoreau and, you know, I'm going to measure this. I'm going to figure this out. The three writers I take are all deeply interested in science and in engineering in very different ways. And so one thing they do is show other ways of using or working with those mental tools. But they're incorporating them in literature too. I just don't want anybody to think of, well, there's science over here and there's writing over there.
Right. Or imagination
Absolutely,
there.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, they seem both very attuned to the realities of
experience. And that's the big struggle. I mean, Thoreau's greatest book really is his journal, and it's very large. It depicts a struggle between the poetic and scientific or empirical writing about nature. And you can trace the progression as he takes more and more control over...
But you just said something, I think, really important, that in writing about nature, there is a struggle between the scientific and, you know, other ways of experiencing and writing about. And back to the event of consciousness, I think what I'm trying to do in my book, in part, is look at environmental history as history, human history. I mean, there's so much written about, quote, environmental history as, you know, all the usual measures, extinction of species or depletion of resources or population or energy use. And these are all very, very real, okay? But it's still not, it's more a material history. It's not a human history. Or to use another example, if we call it the age of the Anthropocene, that's kind of like lifting yourself above human history and looking down on humans as if we are a species, but it's kind of this bird's eye view of what's going on. I'm trying to write environmental history that begins with human perception and human feeling that the world, the historical world has changed because now humans are so dominant and not just kind of one of the mix, but have so much influence about what goes on. And the idea of an inventive consciousness is one effort to try to say that. But without using the language of environment or material history, I guess I'm having a struggle myself.
One thing I think is that for both of you, you're talking about consciousness and you're talking about language and the vocabulary. You're both very careful in the way you approach, nature, for instance, the word that you just used. And the relation between nature and humanity. I mean, the notion that they are polar opposites, that we look at them as a dichotomy and not as sort of humans at some point actually altering the processes of nature. I mean, the profound ways in which we are part of nature is another thing that I feel struggled with.
Well, having taught with Leo for how many years, and I tell you, he really spooks students. Like, if you're going to use the word technology,
exactly. Well, that's another one.
You better be prepared to defend or explain what you mean by that. And I think environment is a very similar word. That like technology, the two often go together. It's kind of like one displacing the other. Anyway, you can say things that you can't say without those words, but you also can trap yourself in a sort of loop.
Yeah.
And if you look at these writers, they're talking about these experiences without using that language. And that's very liberating. It just gives you many more alternatives to speak with.
Right. And you use technology very sparingly in your book.
Well, but in part because the people I'm writing about don't have that word. I don't think they ever use it, but even if that's an overstatement, it's pretty close. But more that it can be a problem word, of just a way of plunking in a placeholder. You know, the word cliché, I understand, in French refers to the piece of type that a typesetter uses. It's not just one letter, but the whole, a common word, so you clunk it in. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to avoid.
Yeah.
But you have technology, of course, in the subtitle of The Machine in the Garden, which, given that it was published almost 50 years ago, is in itself worthy of mention.
Yeah. The other word that appears in that book, which was very new at the time, was ecology.
How about environment? Is that a word you used?
I don't think of one way or the other, whether I did. I must have, but it's possible.
But the point is it certainly didn't dominate.
Thoreau's Journals is really a workshop on these issues, and he records his observations, and people have studied these meticulously. I mean, he becomes more and more, quote, scientific. And less metaphorical. Yeah. And
was that a conscious effort on his part, or
he became more strict about? He was always a keen observer, but he allowed himself to poeticize and so on in the early days. As he went on, he became more and more strictly empirical.
So that's a really interesting analogy with Robert Louis Stevenson, because once he got to the South Seas, he was there because a publisher of a New York newspaper paid him to go there to write letters from the South Seas. And the letters are supposed to be adventurous and colorful and exotic. Stevenson got there, and he was not, very quickly, not interested in doing that because he was seeing a world in crisis, and he wanted to understand it, record it. He started taking notes on the languages, the customs, really ethnographic study. He was trying to turn himself into a social scientist and a natural scientist. He was interested in the coral reefs and had read Darwin and was trying to bring back specimens. His editors, his friends back home, and his wife all thought he was totally wasting his time for being scientific. And that's the word they use. Why are you writing about science and not about adventure and about people? And Stevenson just, you know, he really dug in his heels. And just the book never got published in the form that he meant it to. But we do have his letters, which are very much like a journal, where he's, you know, he's talking about the customs, the death rates. He's trying to speculate.
Is this before or after he was hospitalized?
He was in the South Seas in part to try to regain health.
Before he was up in the Adirondacks?
Yeah, so the New York publisher visited him in Saranac Lake.
Yeah.
And so he's up there, it's 30 degrees below. You know, he's in Saranac Lake for his lungs. The publisher arrives and says, what if I pay you to write me, you know, letters from the South Seas? Well, that's an easy one. So, because either the mountains or the seas were deemed to be a cure, environmental cure for what ailed him. So he agreed. In the next spring, he was off to the Marquesas.
Well, Melville has those sort of yarns. And then when he decided to write Moby Dick, it was a sort of fierce decision to write something more.
Yeah, not what his public wanted. Or what. Yeah.
And very scientific in some parts. So, I mean, when you look at the descriptions of the whale, I'm very rooted in the actual experience of...
Well, not to mention the technology of whale and so Stevenson had read Melville, admired him tremendously, and his first stop in the Marquesas, it was where Melville had sort of been on semi-imprisonment or shore leave or something.
Anyway, that's Taipei.
Do you have more questions?
One question that I think of is bringing it up to date, because obviously this is over a century ago that these writers were coming to terms with a transformed landscape. You talk about the mapping, that this was the end, when the whole world is mapped, and where the front, you know, they were very prescient about that. And I guess the question I have is sort of what's useful about the way they think about these things for us in a much more accelerated crisis of the humans' dominance of nature.
Say that again.
What about their sensibilities and the way that they perceive this?
Yeah.
Can we either be sustained by or learn from, or
so what is another way of asking the question, or is there a usable past?
I don't know if it has to be usable, but I think one thing you start to talk about is that in this period, people are very disoriented, I think, by the accelerated, shifts that human, penetration of the environment have caused. But we don't talk about it that way. We don't talk about...
Oh, we do, but you're supposed to love it. It's called change and innovation.
All right, so that's one thing.
Yeah, and that's all supposed to be... We're all supposed to nod and say, oh, this is great. And I, part of what I'm doing in my book, I think, is saying... it's not like the book. It's kind of work. How's that? Is, who says we have to feel that way? And let's be more honest, I think, about, we're talking, 2 days after the marathon bombing, and I have seen over and over again people say, it will never be the same, and it breaks my heart. Yes. I mean, there are things you want to be the same. You don't want to go away. And so I think this ideology of innovation change, that's one thing that, that these guys, these writers, they don't buy that. Or only, I mean, Vern buys it, say, in part, but there's a whole other part that is mourning, you know, the loss of a world that was familiar to him. So it's not that it's either or. I'm just saying there's a whole range of feelings, I think, that are not appreciated or even accepted in kind of the discourse of historical progress.
Yeah. I mean, it seems to me, to put it in slightly different terms, that the world out there was seen by writers as a source of meaning. Mm-hmm. And you described that world and you elicited meanings from it. As the change accelerated, that source was threatened. The stability of it was threatened. And I think a lot of what we're talking about has to do with the fact that the natural world has come under such pressure from human beings that it is no longer available as a source of meaning. And
it's to be managed.
It's to be managed or to be a sort of little escape,
right.
But not a...
No, that's very well put, and I think there's no one sentence here that's going to capture an answer to your question, like what are we supposed to get out of this? But that I think is one really human experience is being there are many experiences that we are having that we find difficult to articulate and very hard to validate. In a culture that, is always, for lots of reasons of power and money, emphasizing change and instability and glorifying in it. And I think there's a mismatch between that structure, that whole set of structures, and how human beings actually are.
I guess what I was trying to say is what makes these writers sort of fresh and vital 100 years hence. And part of what you're saying is an answer to that. But I also think, and it's related, that their access to this sort of relational experience between it was much more accessible in some ways to them than it often is to us. And therefore, we can relearn, what it means to be part of, to have a relation to nature that isn't utterly human-dominated.
Yeah.
And that it's not like use value, but it's more... that it taps experiences and imaginations that we often don't get tapped.
And they are closer to other sources of articulation and meaning than we are. In other words, we've been cut off from a lot. It's been 100 years. Okay.
Yeah.
So they're cutting edge people. They see, if you will, it's a good modern expression. They see, they're at the very point where all the takeoffs are just taking off.
Right.
They're keenly aware of that, but they also have, for example, so William Morris is studying Icelandic, and he's able to turn sagas into what we now call fantasy literature. I mean, you can't invent fantasy the way he did without being in touch with an older literature.
Yeah.
It just wouldn't have happened. And so that comes out of something that he was connected with. And I think any of these writers, you can look back and say, okay, because they are aware of these traditions or have this vocabulary, that's why they were able to articulate what they did so well.
And they had experiences that are unrepeatable.
I mean, Stevenson on one Pacific island, he says, we're here at this moment in time, 10 years earlier, we probably couldn't have landed here. 10 years later, it's going to be gone. And he was right. He knew it. And the other thing I think these people have to teach us is a moral attitude, which is they're very courageous. You know, if there's wrong, you right it. You know, if there's, you try to improve the world, but they have no illusions that they're going to save the world. You know, history is bigger than they are, and so they don't kid themselves. But they also take as a responsibility being happy in the world, even though what you care about is disappearing. I mean, I think that's a very, very hard balance to make. But they're very explicit about trying to keep some sort of balance, happiness and realism.
I have one last question. Well, I mean, it's sort of related to this, but in the language, I was thinking about sort of vocabulary and the ways that we try to find some middle ground that we can rest in the modern landscape, and sustainability seems to be the word of choice these days. That we're never going to go back to, you know, the kind of plenitude that existed or the open or what, but maybe we can have sustainability, and that's become the word of choice. I'm wondering what you think about that in the context of what these people were sort of looking for. And is it a sort of modern version of the middlescape? The middle landscape, you know, as a word. It's kind of a jargon word.
But a point, you know.
But it has some...
Well, you figure there are only three patterns to history that you can imagine. That it gets better, that's progress. But it goes down, that's apocalypse or decline. Or it's sustainable. Yeah. There are cycles that repeat. And we better figure out what sustainability really means. Because
right. It's one of those words that you can throw out.
Yeah, I think progress is a deep belief in it still. Yeah. But there's also much more a sense of apocalyptic events, not one big one, but just this one and that one and that
overload.
One. Overload. Yeah, and the sense of the end, sort the end of history already being incorporated into history. It's not just out there. So sustainability may be jargon, but it's a very, you know, it's the only hope. But it's a much deeper, much more complicated state than people have begun. This is not just a material state. It's an emotional, it's an intellectual. Anyway, so that's the challenge. Yeah, it's really to take sustainability.
Well, it has an analog in what we've been talking about. I mean, just to go back a little bit, the natural world served literature for centuries as a source of meaning. You found meaning in describing and countering the natural world. That's what books like Moby Dick are about, in fact. But as human beings put a stronger and stronger imprint on the natural world, it ceased to be a source of independent meanings. And that's the great sense of loss that runs through all this, that for writers, the natural world is material for meaning. And so the implication would be you'd have to find your meaning somewhere else. You'd have to construct it. And that's where I think a lot of your thoughts about technology come in. That is that you have a new kind of source. It's much more synthetic and man-made.
But it's still, but it's man-made or human-built, and you know, what's irreplaceable is the other, the other than human.
Yeah. Which is hard to gain access to.
It's when you're always running into yourself that it can be well designed, it can be well engineered, it can be have all the human smarts in it, but it's still, you know, just because it's human built, it's limiting as a source of meaning. So that, I mean, one question about sustainability then is, can we imagine a sustainability that is a human empire? Or can it only be a non-imperial state where humans share the world.
The world has some agency.
Yeah, and I don't know, but that what I said is a much deeper problem.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, how it would look, you know, what are we talking about here?
Yeah, I can answer that. It doesn't look like what is where we're headed now.
Right.
We're not close.
Right.
Thank you. I mean, we could go on forever, but I think...
It's probably...
You know, how much wisdom can you possibly cover in an hour? Anyway. Thank you, really.
So,
do you have any
final words?
Parting shots or comments?
The trend is away from finding meaning out there in the natural world to creating meaning out of whole cloth, out of modern writing.
Yeah.
And then with a book like Joyce's Ulysses, you play on this contrast between what Ulysses was for Ulysses and what it is in a small town in Ireland. There's a sort of ironic treatment of the modern world as a source of meaning, of nature in the modern world.
Yeah.
We no longer count on discovering meaning in the natural.
Yeah.
There's nothing more to discover. I mean, it's basically a question of diminishment.
Right.
Yeah. Now, I think, I'm sure if we had scientists here.
Yes, I was just thinking.
They would argue. If we had scientists here, they would argue that point very strongly.
It's true, and they'd be right.
But I would just say...
What's the
science? I mean, in other words,
about space or where you can find discoveries.
Yeah, caterpillars.
Yeah. Very basic thing.
In science, it's data and molecules and this very
The imagination.
Here's what?
Well, it would inspire the imagination. I mean, to sort of conceive of the
would
black hole or the.
But would it serve the literary imagination?
That's the question. Yeah.
Or would it serve as a general? I mean, science is an incredibly important and significant part of our culture. But I would say for experience of people at large, it's not how nature is experienced. It's just if it had. There are many, many people who just maybe appreciate science but aren't practicing it, and it just doesn't address what we're talking about in terms of a way of finding meaning in the world for societies at large.
Well, the scientific account of cosmic reality doesn't serve very well for poets and novelists.
I would argue that too, but I still think that if science is deeply intellectual, it's deeply philosophical in terms of everyday life experience.
Right.
I'm just stating, I think, trying to make an empirical statement. It does not shape how most people
experience
the non-human world on a daily basis.
Right.
So it's just, I'm just saying it's extremely powerful, but also limited.
Sure. That's a good way to put it.